Chapter 16. The Gigantic Experiment. Man, therefore, may be said to have been trying an experiment on a gigantic scale, and it is an experiment which nature, during the long lapse of time, has incessantly tried. Charles Darwin, The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication. From his first hour on San Cristobal, when he shoved a hawk off a branch with the muzzle of his gun, and saw a finch swatted dead with a hat, Darwin knew that the birds of the Galapagos had no experience with human beings. When he mentions the Galapagos birds in his journal, it is almost always to exclaim at their appalling innocence. "I saw a boy sitting by a well with a switch in his hand, with which he killed the doves and finches as they came to drink," Darwin writes after visiting the prison colony on Floriana. "He had already procured a little heap of them for his dinner, and he said he had constantly been in the habit of waiting there for the same purpose. One day," Darwin writes, "a mockingbird alighted on the edge of a pitcher, made of the shell of a tortoise, which I held in my hand whilst lying down. It began very quietly to sip the water, and allowed me to lift it with the vessel from the ground. I often tried and very nearly succeeded in catching these birds by their legs." Darwin had been reading the second volume of Lyell's Principles of Geology, which he received in his mail at the port of Montevideo. The whole volume is an argument against the possibility of evolution, but Lyell does write about the changes that an invader might bring to an island. When the first polar bears landed in Iceland on an iceberg, for instance, the chaos must have been terrific, Lyell argues. The bears must have feasted on the deer, the foxes, the seals, even some of the birds. With fewer deer on the island, the local plants would have prospered, and also the insects that fed on the plants. With fewer foxes, the ducks would have multiplied, thinning the schools of fish. In this way, "the settling of one new species," Lyell wrote, "might alter the numerical proportions of a great number of the inhabitants, both of the land and sea, and the changes caused indirectly might ramify through all classes of the living creation and be almost endless." For Darwin, the tameness of the Galapagos birds became a symbol of Lyell's lesson. That is how Darwin closes his chapter on the Galapagos in his Journal of Researches, after describing the tameness of the birds. "We may infer from these facts," he writes, "what havoc the introduction of any new beast of prey must cause in a country, before the instincts of the aborigines become adapted to the stranger's craft or power." Darwin elaborates the point in a famous passage in The Origin, a passage that helped establish the science of ecology. "A web of complex relations binds all of the living things in any region," Darwin writes. "Adding or subtracting even a single species causes waves of change that race through the web, onwards in ever-increasing circles of complexity. The simple act of adding cats to an English village would reduce the number of field mice. Killing mice would benefit the bumblebees, whose nests and honeycombs the mice often devour. Increasing the number of bumblebees would benefit the heartsease and red clover, which are fertilized almost exclusively by bumblebees. So adding cats to the village could end by adding flowers." For Darwin, the whole of the Galapagos archipelago argues this fundamental lesson. The volcanoes are much more diverse in their biology than their geology. The contrast suggests that in the struggle for existence, species are shaped at least as much by the local flora and fauna as by the local soil and climate. Why else would the plants and animals differ radically among islands that have the same geological nature, the same height, climate, etc.? "This long appeared to me a great difficulty," Darwin writes toward the end of The Origin, "but it arises in chief part from the deeply seated error of considering the physical conditions of a country as the most important for its inhabitants, whereas it cannot, I think, be disputed that the nature of the other inhabitants, with which each has to compete, is at least as important, and generally a far more important element of success. When each seed and bird arrived on one of these islands, he says, it would have to compete with different sets of organisms, and it would be exposed to the attacks of somewhat different enemies. If then it varied, natural selection would probably favor different varieties in the different islands. Again, Darwin never actually saw this happen. But he concluded that the introduction of a new species anywhere on Earth might be an evolutionary event, that small invasions can have far-reaching consequences. The invader itself evolves rapidly as it adapts to its new home. Meanwhile, everything already living there either adapts to the invader or becomes extinct. The result is an expanding pulse of evolution and extinction, a general acceleration of the pace of change. In the past, the pace of travel was generally slow. The finch had to wait for the freak wind. The polar bear had to wait for the iceberg. The union and disunion of continents were limited by the pace of continental drift, which is measured in centimeters per year. Today, invasions on this scale are happening every day, and virtually every spot on the surface of the planet is being assaulted by varied new evolutionary pressures. Invaders ride in the puddles of old car tires, the bilge water of ships, the pressurized cabins of airplanes, in suitcases, on pant legs, and on mud-caked shoe soles. These are Darwin's old jelly jar experiments replayed in earnest. The consequence is an intensification of Darwinian pressures, not only in the Galapagos, but everywhere we look. The Yankee evolutionist, Herman Cary Bumpus, witnessed one small step of an invasion at the close of Darwin's century. On the last day in January 1898, Providence, Rhode Island was struck by a howling blizzard. The storm blocked the streetcars and the railroad trains, snapped the telegraph and telephone lines, and threw sparks from dangling wires onto the shingled roof of Walter H. Willis's furnishing store. According to the front-page story in the next day's Providence Journal, the fire was put out with snowballs by a crowd of merrymakers. Bumpus was teaching biology at Brown University. His path to work each morning led up College Hill and past the Providence Athenaeum, one of the oldest libraries in the United States. The morning after the storm, as he made his way through the snow, he happened to notice a large number of English sparrows lying dead or exhausted in the drifts beneath the Athenaeum. The sparrows had been wintering in the ivy that covered the library, and the gale had overwhelmed them. These sparrows were newcomers to New England, as Bumpus knew. Old world birds in the New World. One of the first pairs had been released in New York's Central Park in 1851, the decade before Bumpus was born, by an eccentric bird lover who wanted to import every one of the birds in Shakespeare's plays to the United States. So the birds were lying in the snow that morning, in part because Shakespeare had written, "There is a special providence in the fall of a sparrow." Bumpus collected as many of the sparrows as he could and brought them to the anatomical laboratory. In the warmth of the lab, 72 of the sparrows revived. 64 died. He recorded the sex, body length, wingspans, and weight of both the living and the dead. He also measured the length of the head, the humerus, the femur, the tibiotarsus, the skull, and the sternum. When he tabulated all these results, he found that most of the survivors were males, and that among the males, the survivors tended to be shorter and lighter than average, with longer wing bones, longer legs, longer sternums, and greater brain capacity. At the time, English sparrows were multiplying and overrunning the continent. Bumpus believed that the English sparrow, since its introduction into this country, has found life so easy that the operation of natural selection has been practically suspended, and that the American type consequently has become degenerate. The birds that had died in the storm were those that had diverged most from the original type. It was an episode of what is now called stabilizing selection. In the early 1970s, just before his first trip to the Galapagos, Peter Grant reread Bumpus's paper and studied the tables of numbers. The paper had long since become one of the most famous studies ever conducted of evolution in action. Peter reanalyzed the data using more powerful statistical tools. He concluded that Bumpus had actually seen not one but two kinds of natural selection. For the female sparrows, the storm was stabilizing. The event killed the largest and the smallest, but preserved the mean, just as Bumpus had said. In the males, however, the pressure of the storm was directional, pushing the birds towards smaller size. The reanalysis of Bumpus's classic data helped to inspire the Grants' first trip to the Galapagos. There was a providence in the fall of those sparrows. If you could demonstrate natural selection under those freakish conditions, Peter and Rosemary wondered what they could see under more normal conditions. They might not be able to see it at all. Today, English sparrows are still evolving and adapting to North America, and to South America, South Africa, Hawaii, Australia, and New Zealand, through Darwin's process. So are barnacles that invaded the Salton Sea during World War II, riding in with the U.S. Navy. So are fruit flies that invaded Chile in the 1970s. With these species and many others, biologists are now tracking evolution in action, quite confident, as the Grants and other studies pile up, that the process can be watched. Each of these creatures, now that we have put it down in a new place in the world, is in the middle of a crisis, an epical event, like the first finches to land in the Galapagos, and their evolution, like the finches, is turning out to be rapid. Whenever we introduce an alien to a new country, we also change life for the natives. Lyell's point in the parable of the polar bear, and Darwin's in his vision of cats helping flowers. This kind of chain of events is going on everywhere, too, and it, too, is being watched. The evolutionist Scott Carroll of the University of Utah is proving the point with the beak of the soapberry bug. This is a bug with a long needle of a proboscis, which is, in effect, its beak. The bug pokes its beak through the walls of fruit, pierces the walls of the seeds, and then liquefies and sucks up the nutrients, as if it were sipping cider through a straw. Carroll, who is one of the tallest biologists in the world, has spent many of his working hours in the last few years stooping over soapberry bugs from Yavapai County, Arizona, to Key Largo, Florida. They are New World bugs, rather pretty-looking things. Carroll paints black numbers on their backs to keep track of individuals and watches them eat. At the start of his study, he says, he assumed they would be like little wind-up automata, but they are not. Privately, he has come to believe as he watches them that they are each different, with personalities. But that is off the subject of his quest. In the south-central United States, soapberry bugs live on the soapberry tree. In southernmost Texas, they live on the Serranía line. In southern Florida, they live on the perennial balloon vine. These are its native hosts. The bug and these plants go back thousands of years. Besides these three native plants, the bugs also steal seeds from three species that have been introduced to their turf quite recently, the round-potted golden rain tree and the flat-potted golden rain tree, which have been imported from Southeast Asia as ornamentals, and the heartseed vine, which grows wild in Louisiana and Mississippi. The beak of the soapberry bug is easy to measure, and the meaning of the variations is obvious. Someone once asked Abe Lincoln how long he thought a man's legs should be. Abe is said to have replied, "Just long enough to reach the ground." Likewise, the beak of the soapberry bug should be just long enough to reach the seeds. Now, the fruit of the balloon vine, which is native to South Florida, has a radius of a dozen millimeters. The beak length of the soapberry bugs that feed on it is a little more than 9 millimeters, long enough to reach the seeds, which cluster around the center of the fruit. But the fruit of the flat-potted golden rain tree, which is new to Florida, has a radius of less than 3 millimeters. The soapberry bugs that eat these fruits do not need such long beaks, and accordingly, their beaks are growing shorter. They now average less than 7 millimeters long. That is rapid evolution, since the golden tree was not planted in any significant numbers in Florida until the 1950s, several thousand generations for the bugs. With time, their beaks are likely to grow shorter yet. Meanwhile, the fruit of the native soapberry tree has a radius of only 6 millimeters, and the beaks of the bugs that dine on it are 6 millimeters long. But the fruit of the newly introduced heartseed vine is almost 9 millimeters. Soapberry bugs that have switched to heartseed now have beaks almost 8 millimeters long. That is even faster evolution, for heartseed did not become abundant in the territory of soapberry bugs until about 1970. With time, their beaks will grow even longer. Carroll has also measured specimens of these bugs in state and county natural history museums. In case after case, he finds a change in beak length at about the right time, that is, about the time the new plants were introduced in their territory. In every case, the beaks of the soapberry bugs are evolving to obey Lincoln's rule, just long enough to reach the seeds. And because the dates of introductions of the new plants are known so well, and are so recent, it is clear that this is yet another example of evolution in action around us, with the driver and the driven both plainly in view. Carroll calls this natural history with the history. Darwin suspected that this kind of change in habits might sometimes lead in surprising directions. In The Origin, he notes that there are species of British insects that feed exclusively on British farmers' crops. Meanwhile, the insect's ancestral line goes on eating the native weeds in the woods and hedgerows around the farmers' fields. Darwin concludes that, within the same area, varieties of the same animal can long remain distinct, from haunting different stations, from breeding at slightly different seasons, or from varieties of the same kind preferring to pair together. He thought that many new and perfectly defined species might have been formed this way, not on islands, but side by side in the fields and hedgerows of rural England. One of The Origin's first readers in the New World was a British graduate of Cambridge from the same year as Darwin. Benjamin Walsh had studied for the church in Cambridge, and like Darwin, he had discovered that he preferred bug collecting. Instead of setting up in a country estate outside London, as Charles and Emma did, Walsh and his wife sailed for the United States. In Illinois, Walsh built a mud-plastered log cabin with a fireplace that took a log that had to be rolled in with oxen, as he later wrote to Darwin at Down. I was possessed with an absurd notion that I would live a perfectly natural life, independent of the whole world, in me ipso totis teres atque rotundus. So I bought several hundred acres of wild land in the wilderness, 20 miles from any settlement that you would call even a village, and with only a single neighbor. There I gradually opened a farm, working myself like a horse. By the time Darwin published The Origin, Walsh had caught malaria, lost 2 farms, built a lumber business, built 10 brick tenements, stormed into and out of local politics, and settled back at last into entomology. In 1864, he sent a letter to England. More than 30 years ago, I was introduced to you at your rooms in Christ's College, and had the pleasure of seeing your noble collection of British coleoptera. Allow me to take this opportunity for thanking you for the publication of your Origin of Species. The first perusal staggered me, the second convinced me, and the oftener I read it, the more convinced I am of the general soundness of your theory. Walsh applied Darwin's ideas to what he saw happening in the fields and woods around him. There is a species of Native American fruit fly, commonly known as the hawfly, that lays its eggs on wild hawthorn. In Walsh's day, farmers had begun planting and cultivating apple orchards in the Hudson River Valley. Some hawflies had left the haws and begun eating the apples. Although this species of fly exists both in the East and in the West, Walsh wrote in 1867, it attacks the cultivated apples only in a certain limited region, even in the East, for this new and formidable enemy of the apple is found in the Hudson River Valley, but has not yet reached New Jersey. He predicted that the flies would continue to spread, and that they might eventually begin to diverge. The hawflies and the apple flies might go on living side by side, yet turn into 2 separate species, as Darwin suggests in The Origin. Unfortunately, Walsh died soon after publishing his paper on the apple fly, but the flies did spread as he predicted. They were reported north of the Hudson River Valley, in Vermont and New Hampshire in 1872, in Maine in 1876, in Canada in 1907. By 1894, they were marching through Georgia, and by 1902, they were in Michigan. They are now eating apples up and down the east coast of North America and in the Midwest. In the last decade, they arrived on the west coast. The fly also eats rose hips, and sometimes pears and plums, and in the Door Peninsula in Wisconsin, it has just begun eating sour cherries. Meanwhile, hawflies still eat haws. Currently, most evolutionists regard the possibility of speciation among neighbors as unorthodox, even though Darwin himself proposed it. The standard model of speciation requires geographic isolation. That has been the canonical pattern for half a century, and many evolutionists believe it is the universal pattern. But evolutionists are forever dividing and subdividing into schismatic sects, kingdoms of either and or. Do new species arise in archipelagos like Darwin's finches, or do they arise among neighbors? Is the origin of species fast or slow? Is the mechanism natural selection or sexual selection? And so on. None of these questions really have to be framed either or. It is almost a law of science. The more indirect the evidence, the more polarized the debate. Evolutionists sometimes catch themselves sounding like the little Endians and big Endians in Gulliver's Travels, fighting tooth and nail over the proper way to crack an egg. Meanwhile, the more direct the evidence, the less answers look either or. Flies that have switched from haws to apples lay their eggs in an apple while it is still on the tree. The eggs hatch within 2 days, and the larva grows and grows, hollowing and honeycombing the fruit as it eats. When the apple ripens and falls to the ground, the larvae dig down into the soil. They spend the winter dormant in the ground at the foot of the tree they infested the summer before. By the time the next summer comes, they are ready for another crop of apples. The flies mate only on the trees where they feed. Early in the season, according to one apple fly expert, the male flies toward the female and stares at her, face to face, within 1 or 2 centimeters. And then, if the gestalt of visual characteristics suggests that the insect is indeed of the same species, jumps onto her abdomen and attempts to copulate, often on top of an apple. Later in the season, the courtship pattern changes. The males establish territories and defend their turf from other males while they wait for females to alight nearby. 2 apple flies sometimes battle each other for possession of an apple. So these flies' lives seem to be growing more and more entwined with the apple trees. They may be in the act of cutting themselves off from the hawflies and forming a new species, just as Walsh predicted a century ago. A young evolutionist, Jeffrey Feder, is now investigating this possibility at the molecular level. In one study, he looked at haw and apple flies in an old abandoned orchard near the town of Grant, Michigan. He and his co-workers examined 6 enzymes in the flies. For all 6 enzymes, Feder found slight differences between the flies on the haws and the flies on the apples. The differences really are extremely slight. In fact, Feder found precisely the same 6 enzymes in both the haw flies and the apple flies. He also found the same variant forms of the 6 enzymes. The haw and apple flies differed only in the proportions, the relative numbers of the variant forms. It is as if human beings on 2 continents each carried the same set of genes for eye color, blue, brown, black, green. But on 1 continent, blue was more common than black. And on the other, black was more common than blue. The gene pools of the 2 races of flies in the orchard seem to be partly joined and partly isolated. We may be watching the very earliest stages in the divergence of 2 species. In a more extensive study, Feder looked at 24 enzymes in flies from 12 orchards around the United States and Canada. He saw that all over the continent, the gene pools of the apple race and the haw race have diverged in this way. Apples ripen and fall about 1 month earlier than haws. When the flies tie themselves to the apples, their feeding and breeding schedules have to shift about 1 month ahead in the calendar. 1 month is a lifetime for these flies. It is nearly the entire lifespan of an adult fruit fly. So the switch to apples is pushing the 2 gene pools apart. Hawflies and appleflies are marooned on islands in time rather than islands in space. They seem to be taking the first steps toward speciation, just as Darwin and Walsh imagined. The same thing must be happening unseen in thousands of other species around the world, because farms offer new islands and niches for insects everywhere, as every farmer knows and regrets. Coddling moths, too, have adapted to North American apple orchards, since the moths arrived in the Hudson River Valley 200 years ago. Other populations of coddling moths specialize in Persian walnuts, Swiss apricots, South African pears, California plums. Treehoppers have diverged and branched in 6 divergent directions to specialize in 6 different genera of trees and bushes, including bittersweet, butternut, viburnum, and cirsus. Treehoppers in each genus of tree do not mate with treehoppers in another tree, even if the two trees grow side by side. The reproductive isolation of the treehoppers is complete. Fetter has also studied a line of flies that looks identical to hawflies and appleflies, but infests blueberries and huckleberries. It is a menace in blueberry patches from Nova Scotia to Florida, and as far west as Michigan. If you take some appleflies and some blueberry flies and put them in a jar together, they will mate and produce perfectly normal-looking, healthy hybrid flies. They appear to be absolutely interfertile in the jar. But Fetter has inspected the genes of adult flies collected from neighboring blueberry bushes and apple trees. He finds that their genes are clearly distinct and species-specific, peculiar to the apple fly or the blueberry fly. So they hybridize rarely, if at all, in the wild. They are not passing genes back and forth between them. Even when the highest branches of a blueberry bush and the lowest branches of an apple tree are interdigitated, mingling like the fingers of two hands, the two species of flies are still not mixing. Each fly is feeding on the fruit of its kind and mating true to its kind, as isolated as if the blueberry and the apple flies lived on far-flung islands.